Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. In honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day and paying service to our collective love of history, this week's episode will feature a discussion on MLK's connection to baseball and how his presence continues to be felt. King had several connections to the world of baseball, both while he was living and after his assassination. This includes his friendship with Jackie Robinson and the fact that baseball labor rights pioneer Curt Flood considered King one of his personal idols. We'll start by each sharing some anecdotes about baseball's ties to MLK.
Okay, so I'll go first. Mine has to do with May 26th and May 27th, 1963. On both days, he held rallies at each Wrigley Field, the first one in Los Angeles and then in Chicago. And so this happened about 2 weeks after campaign heads and Martin Luther King Jr. Reached an agreement in order to end all of the violence that was occurring in Birmingham. However, that agreement did not go over well. And then the motel where Martin Luther King Jr. had stayed the previous night was bombed, and his brother's house was bombed. And then that started a lot of protests again. So, and then national troops went into Birmingham on behalf of JFK to try and end things. This kind of created a lot of civil unrest and widespread fear across the country, and it left a lot of civil rights groups kind of wondering what they could do to help end all of that violence. So they got together and they were like, okay, we'll hold rallies at various places across the country. And these were all kind of arranged very, very quickly with any, black leaders in each of the communities that wanted to pitch in. So on May 26th, he went to, Wrigley Field in Los Angeles. And he held a rally there for about 35,000 people, which was over the park's capacity. And a bunch of Hollywood stars came down to join the rally and to support MLK Jr., donate a bunch of money, including Sammy Davis Jr., Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, Rita Moreno. So a lot of big, big names at the time. And so then that one raised about $35,000, which at that point was the most money raised for a civil rights cause in one go. And then the next morning, he made his way to Chicago for a rally that evening. So he was very, very busy time for him. And then that rally, it wasn't expected to be as large because they had even less time to plan it. And it was in a much whiter area of the country. Nonetheless, a lot of people turned out, roughly the same crowd size as the previous Wrigley. And they donated upwards of $40,000, which was the most that had ever been raised for a civil rights cause, eclipsing the $35,000 of the previous night. And so those two events really kind of kicked off the Birmingham rally and the Birmingham campaign all across the country, which raised thousands, hundreds and thousands of dollars for the civil rights movement. They were kind of the two pillars of this entire movement. And they happened in baseball stadiums because, as everybody knows, baseball was big for MLK, both personally and in terms of civil rights outreach. And then baseball stadiums at that point were also the largest places of gathering in these places. So it was both practical and personal. And that's my story.
That's really fascinating. I didn't really know the details of those rallies and how much money they brought in, or the really the fact that he did that 2 days in a row. That's wow.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Yeah, I can't imagine going from LA to Chicago in and then, having to speak and do everything again within a few hours like that. Like, that plane ride would just kind of wipe me out by itself. So that's remarkable.
Well, my anecdote takes place 5 years later, and as you can figure out, that's 1968. You know, most people listening are probably aware that's the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and this centers around that. He was assassinated April 4th of that year, and the opening day for that season was scheduled for April 8th. The Pittsburgh Pirates had a number of players who were not interested in playing until after King's funeral had taken place. This charge was led, unsurprisingly, by Roberto Clemente, but this was also a team that had Maury Wills and Willie Stargell and a number of other African-American and African-Latino players. And so it's not all that surprising that this would be a team that would be sort of making this push. They wanted all of the games to be postponed. The commissioner sort of waffled on this. His name was William Eckert. He said that teams could decide for themselves whether or not they were going to play. Yeah. So obviously this wasn't really good enough, because what ended up happening was the Pirates' opponent for that day, the Astros, decided that they were going to play. And the Pirates were like, okay, no, we're not going to play. And that forced a postponement of both of the first two games that they were supposed to play. Other players throughout baseball also expressed discontent with Eckert's decision, and ultimately he had to relent and postpone all of the opening games for that baseball season until April 10th, which was the day after King's funeral. So, you know, we know Clemente as this big proponent of civil rights who did a lot of things that were very important for humanitarian causes, but I think this is sort of a chapter of his career that got glossed over for, you know, not necessarily for any malicious reason, just because there's so many other things you can talk about with Clemente that, you know, this may not be among the top 10 most memorable, which is saying a lot about who he was as a person and a you know, member of our society. But yeah, I think that is sort of really amazing that the Pirates were able to rally together and do that. Interestingly enough, you know, Eckert would have to deal with this again just 2 months later with RFK's assassination. And, you know, I don't envy someone in that position having to deal with making big decisions around these things, you know, twice in the span of 2 months. But also, he did not really do a great job handling it. And it's kind of too bad that that is part of his legacy, because it would have been so easily avoided if he'd just been like, you're right, we should make note of this really huge thing that happened and just not play these days. Like, it's 2 days. We can wait 2 days to start playing baseball. But he did not do that.
Yeah, I think both those incidents, because they happened so closely, really caused a lot of division for a lot of teams. I know that a bunch of teams were kind of split, where the players kind of wanted to postpone, and the owners were like, oh no, that'll cost us too much money, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it's just kind of insane that they happened so closely together.
Yeah. And a lot of the players who were really profoundly affected by MLK's assassination were also big Kennedy supporters. So, you know, like, I first read about this in a book about the 1960s Dodgers. And although by this point, Maury Wills was on the Pirates, you know, it's still worth mentioning his involvement in all this. And he was very much big on trying to get the games on are leading up to RFK's burial to be postponed. So just kind of interesting to see how, you know, those events, I guess, one sort of tied to the other in certain ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like a lot of instances in baseball and the civil rights movement are linked one way or another, just because of everything happening in a short period of time, and, you know, no one expected the assassinations, but, you know, you would think that if they had to deal with assassination and postponing games beforehand, they would be prepared if it were to happen again. But I guess MLB did not think of that then. So my anecdote is actually kind of the opposite, in which baseball kind of had an impact on MLK. So this is from a Sports Illustrated article in 2010 by Dave Zirin. And I'm just going to read the two paragraphs because I don't think my own words could do this justice. But as a teenager in 1947, he watched with rapt attention as Jackie Robinson broke the racial barrier in Major League Baseball. A decade later, as Robinson's career was winding down with the Brooklyn Dodgers, Robinson started to speak out for civil rights. Many people in the press and civil rights community discouraged Robinson from taking the step, worried it would tarnish his image, and even argued that as an athlete, Robinson had no vocal place in the struggle. But King, by then the movement's undisputed leader, said that Robinson had every right to speak because he was, quote, a pilgrim that walked in the lonesome byways toward the high road of freedom. He was a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. And emboldened Robinson toward the South to speak for civil rights and became the most requested speaker on the circuit, more requested than even Dr. King. He would end every speech the same way, saying, "If I had to choose tomorrow between the Baseball Hall of Fame and full citizenship for my people, I would choose full citizenship time and again." So I just found that really, really interesting because everyone at this point knows of Jackie Robinson's impact on baseball and how it helped integration. But I don't think a lot of people really connect Jackie Robinson to the civil rights movement of the late 50s and the 60s, but certainly it had to have had an impact on so many people, and clearly it impacted Dr. King. So I think it's just interesting how, you know, Robinson impacted Dr. King when he was a teenager, and, you know, seeing this integration happen, and then Dr. King, you know, reaffirming that Robinson has a place in the movement and reaffirming that what he's saying should be said because he was, you know, in many ways a pioneer of the civil rights movement.
It's also interesting that their paths crossed, you know, on many occasions, sometimes intentionally because the two of them were reaching out to each other. But in 1957, they both received honorary doctorates of law from Howard University. There's this picture, if you, you know, Google the two of them, where they're both in their caps and gowns. And it's just kind of surreal because at that point, Jackie is not that far removed from retirement, and MLK has yet to really break out on the big national stage the way that he did. So just sort of interesting to, you know, see that they intersected in that way kind of before you think of these things that they ended up doing together later on. And also, but I guess also after Jackie's original impact on Martin Luther King.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, everything here just kind of reiterates, I think one of the kind of pillars of our podcast is to demonstrate that baseball and politics and social issues are so intertwined that you can never really disconnect or disentangle one from the other.
Yeah, it's all overlapping at the very least. There's no way to separate any of the issues because, as one of the things that I learned in grad school in a sports journalism class was, sports influences society and society influences sports. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
King's legacy, of course, extends far beyond the years he was active in the country as a whole and in baseball. So how do we see King's influence in using baseball as a medium for civil rights discourse?
I mean, I think that we kind of see it in a lot of different areas from, you know, from looking at civil rights, kind of the way that he shaped it in those years, to looking at all of the players, such as Curt Flood, who impacted baseball somewhat, you know, on his behalf to players today that, you know, look back at MLK and see him as a hero and see him as somebody they want to represent.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about Curt Flood and how, you know, no one player had a bigger impact on players' rights than he did. And it's just a fact that he considered Martin Luther King to be one of his personal heroes. You know, he painted a portrait of him. That's how much he admired him. And the portrait actually ended up being given as a gift to Coretta Scott King. So, yeah, I think you definitely need to talk about how the original really big baseball labor movement and the face of that was someone who was really influenced by King and who was willing to, you know, sacrifice his own career and his own well-being for this principle that he had. And, you know, I guess you see that from time to time with things like strikes, you know, players who, you know, realize that they don't need to be subservient to the will of ownership, and they actually have voices and they can stand up for the things that they believe in and what is rightfully theirs. So yeah, I think this all goes back to Curt Flood, and I think, you know, with Curt Flood it all goes back to MLK.
Yeah, and I think it really helps to do away with the distinction that a lot of white people like to make between MLK and Malcolm X, whereas, you know, MLK was this big pacifist who just spoke about peace and love and tolerance and so on and so forth, whereas that wasn't really the case. And I think you see it with all of these players, particularly in the Curt Flood era, where they realize that asking politely has gotten them nowhere and they need to take actual action and they need to stand up for themselves and stand up for everybody else and try and create a foundation on which later players can build.
Yeah, and I think another important thing with Dr. King's influence, especially in sports, I only know that it's been Bruce Maxwell kneeling for the anthem in MLB, and I know Chris Archer made some comments publicly about how, you know, it's kind of the clubhouse culture that prevents someone from kneeling for the anthem to kind of protest the racial injustices in America. So this is kind of a twofold. The protests in itself, because it's, you know, a silent, non-disruptive protest, just kind of reminds me of Dr. King's tactics with his protests, such as sit-ins, you know, non-violent, silent, not really causing a commotion, but people will, you know, do with it what they will. But the thing is, it still starts a discussion even more. And the second part is, how can baseball listen to the past with the civil rights era, such as Dr. King and Malcolm X, and how can they change clubhouse culture so that, you know, non-white athletes in the game can speak their mind about potentially divisive issues, but, you know, for the greater good of society? I think that's something that baseball is going to have to address this year, especially since Maxwell was kneeling towards the end of the season. Wasn't really that much discussion to be had because, you know, plays for the A's weren't going to make it to the playoffs. But there's a bigger issue at hand, you know, but from the racist taunts, you know, at Fenway Park towards players such as Adam Jones and CeCe Sabathia, as they've noted, and, you know, just kneeling for the anthem, there's going to be a lot more discussion, I think, and this year does mark the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, and it just kind of is upsetting in a sense to see that 50 years later there's still a lot of racial injustice. So.
Yeah, I think people have to, you know, the ownership and the MLBPA to an extent have to realize that having a day for him where players kind of, you know, celebrate him and so on and so forth is not really enough of a tribute to his legacy and to what he wanted to do for this country.
Absolutely. I think the best way to honor Dr. King's legacy in this instance is to kind of listen to what he was talking about and kind of follow and abide by what he wanted for the world. So baseball needs to step it up and listen to that.
But. Yeah, I think baseball for a very long time has been coasting on Jackie Robinson. I think they like to be able to point to him to be like, look, we were ahead of the curve, so to speak, by, you know, having our league integrated long before, you know, segregation was, you know, in effect done away with in the United States. And, you know, it's a progressive sport because of that. But the fact of the matter is that's not really the case. If they really want to, you know, keep up that image or, you know, actually be worthy of it, then it needs to be safer for players to speak out about what they perceive to be as racial injustice, or, you know, to feel safe in their clubhouse to be able to, you know, nonviolently protest, you know, that, and it just, yeah, to, you know, rely on one event that happened, you know, 70 years ago at this point, it's 2018.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not good enough. It would be very refreshing if, you know, baseball could kind of catch up with the times and maybe even get ahead of the times, but it's hard to be too hopeful about that happening.
Yeah, I think with baseball, they can say that they're one of the more progressive sports, kind of coasting on the fact that, you know, Jackie Robinson entered the league, you know, nearly 70 years ago, and, you know, saying that they integrated long before integration happened in all of the country. But a sport can't necessarily be progressive if it's stuck hanging itself on its laurels from the past. So.
Yeah, I think there just needs to be a much wider recognition of the intersection between race and labor politics, and how you can't, you know, address one without addressing the other.
Exactly. After a few weeks off, we're bringing back our What Baseball Means to Me segment. Our guest today is a baseball fan who's one of our favorite Twitter follows, Crystal Owens. Crystal, how are you today?
I am doing well. A little caffeinated, but that's a good thing.
So we usually start this segment off by getting an idea of who we're talking to. So tell us what your age is and your favorite team is.
So I am 28 years old, and my favorite team is the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Yeah. So what first made you interested in baseball?
So back when I was younger, when I lived in Nebraska, I actually, in elementary school, we actually took regular baseball or regular field trips to Rosenblatt Stadium. It's just a minor league park in Omaha, Nebraska. It's where they used to play the College World Series. And for the most part, like, I wasn't interested, but I also was, because obviously it's a free pass from school, and it's just hanging out with your friends, playing or watching a game. It was very fun. So that kind of made me interested in baseball, but I never really did anything about it because I felt like that was going to give my dad a little bit of power over me. My dad's a huge sports fan, so it makes sense. I wasn't interested in doing things that my parents liked. But when we moved to Las Vegas, later on in my like adulthood, I started watching more games, started realizing that, hey, this is actually kind of a fun sport. And then one year I was like extremely depressed and like all I did was watch baseball. So now then all of a sudden now I'm here. I know it's kind of unlinear and unfocused, but that's what it is.
I think that's how fandom goes for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, various things happen and one day you're like, oh my God, I love baseball so much.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, there's so many like baseball metaphors that are just part of our language that every time I use one, I'm like, I can't believe I just said that. That's so corny. But anyway, right away when introducing you, we mentioned that we all follow you on Twitter and we think that you're one of the best tweeters that there is.
Oh, that is so sweet because I'm such a mess.
No, you're great. Would you say that social media has impacted your baseball fandom?
It really, like, honestly, it kind of broke it open. A lot of my friends here in Las Vegas aren't like huge sports fans. So Twitter and my dad are pretty much the only outlets I have when it comes to like talking about baseball. And with my dad, it's both us yelling things at each other just to upset each other. In a very loving way for that matter. We just like needling each other, but like on Twitter, I'm able to actually just really fully, or I'm more willing to really fully be serious about it and have like full blown discussions with people. So I think Twitter has probably made me a more intense fan than I would have been without it.
I think we can all identify with that. I think Twitter kind of heightens everybody's emotions, both positively and negatively. So kind of along those lines, what's the most difficult part of being a fan for you?
I think, again, going back to the Twitter part, because of most of my interactions are on Twitter, it's really difficult sometimes to really navigate, like finding fans that are really like with a similar viewpoint with you. Because since it's online, a lot of men in general, use it as an excuse to really be on their worst behavior and like take everything with bad faith and just be overall monsters.
Yeah.
So it's really hard sometimes to separate the good from the bad. But since I feel like I accidentally fell with a good, like, clique of people, you guys included, it at least makes that like, web a little bit more manageable, because it's like I could check in with people, be like, hey, how is this person? What's going on with them? Do you guys have any experience with them? And I could, most times I could get a really good definitive, like, answer about it. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Makes absolute sense.
Well, on sort of the flip side of the coin, what would you say is the best thing about being a baseball fan?
I think it's the sense of community. Like, I know I just spent like 2-3 minutes like talking bad about it, but there's just a little bit, like, despite everything, there's a, like, an understanding between everyone. Like, no matter, like, who you're rooting for, what team you're for against, like, there's a general sense of understanding of, like, wow, this season, or baseball is really long. Everyone has their equal chances of getting their heart broken. Like, everyone knows, like, and gets in, is very compassionate about the ways of feelings, like, it gives you. Like, even, like, during, after Game 7 of the World Series, like, even the one solo Astro fan, like, who I follow, who are extremely, who was extremely excited for the win, checked in on me and be like, I hope you're okay. And, like, and it wasn't, like, in the condescending way. It was very caring and kind. And, like, I met some really great people, and formed really great connections. And, like, I have so many people's phone numbers now. And then we just, like, talk and chat and just, not just about baseball, but our lives in general. And I find that really sweet. It's really nice. There's, like, a human component involved, a really genuine human component. And I think that's really sweet and romantic.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I know that the three of us on this podcast wouldn't have found each other if it weren't for social media. And, we wouldn't have found you if it weren't for social media, baseball. And it's like, I don't know. It's so nice. There's so many people in our lives that are just so important to us that, you know, are in it because we all care about this stupid game that, you know, is torturous sometimes, but that we can't break away from because we love it so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a finite number of people who understand baseball on this level, and there's a finite number of people who understand baseball Twitter on this level. So when we all find one another, it's like, oh, thank goodness. Like, yeah. People really get us.
Exactly.
So, yeah, because sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, because sometimes, like, my sisters and even my closest friends look at me like I'm going through something, and my coworkers, especially, oh my god, during the World Series, or at least Game 5 through 7 when I was actually at work, they were just all looking at me like I was a ticking time bomb. But, like, online, everyone was just like, we get it, Crystal, we understand.
Oh, baseball, such.
Yeah.
I constantly think of baseball as both the most dramatic and the most petty sport out there because it's so long, there's so many games, and then you have things like, you know, an on-deck circle being dragged just to take off an ump because pettiness, and that's basically the sport in a nutshell, dramatic and petty.
I really agree with that, especially the use of the word petty.
Yeah, I think maybe more so than any sport, baseball really, fits into a specific type of personality.
Yeah, I mean, we call baseball dramatic and petty, but really, I think it's the fans who are truly the dramatic and petty ones, because we can be so over the top sometimes, and, like, so unnecessarily, you know, just, like, having these, like, weird vindictive things against players or other fans for just, like, the most ridiculous reasons, and you realize, I really don't have any reason to not, you know, like this person or whatever, but that's just, I guess, the personality type of the average baseball fan, because it's in line with what we see in the sport and what, I guess, the sport does to us.
Yeah, that is agree. I spent, like, half of the 2017 season really mad at the Rockies, and I can't even tell you why I was really mad at the Rockies, but I was just really pissed off about them. And then all of a sudden the Wild Coyote game, and it happened and I'm like, I actually don't remember why I'm mad, and I'm just really enjoying this, so I'm just gonna just forget whatever anger I had, which I forgot. I was really mad at the Rockies.
It's like they didn't, I think it was because people kept expecting them to sort of peter out and to not, you know, be as competitive as they were for the entirety of the season. And they just kept at it, and it was like, okay, you're making me look bad, because I was like, oh yeah, they're gonna flame out like they always do. And I mean, sure, they got the second wild card, but that's more competitive than the Rockies have been in a really long time. So, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So thank you for coming on and for the interesting discussion, Crystal. We love having you on here.
Thank you.
You can follow Crystal on Twitter at CrushSong, which we all encourage you to do. Now moving on to our Twitter questions. So this one is from Jack at JFordBear. What can be done by MLB or the MLBPA to make teams less stingy in free agency like we're seeing now?
I think something that the MLBPA should work toward is making the years of team control shorter so that players kind of hit free agency more like either right before they start their peak years or like right during them as opposed to towards the end or immediately after, where teams can, you know, more or less have this internal justification for paying players less.
That makes a lot of sense. I think I have arbitration on the brain right now, just because, say, for the Gerrit Cole trade that finally happened, that, you know, most of the news we've gotten recently has been, oh, you know, such and such team settled with so and so at such and such an amount, avoiding arbitration, or in some cases, not being able to settle and, you know, going on to arbitration. And I think that what really stood out to me was what happened with Mike Foltynewicz, which I know I'm not saying that correctly, but he filed at $2.3 million and the Braves filed at $2.2 million. So it's a difference of $100,000 there, and they have to go to arbitration over $100,000, which is kind of ridiculous. And I wonder if the Players Association could do something where it's like, if a player and a team file at a difference of like, you know, $500,000 or less maybe, and, you know, the player files higher. I think that in that case, I think the team should just, you know, go to meet what the player is asking for, because maybe that will be a preventative measure later on so that teams don't have to worry about spending as much in free agency, but rather are giving players close to something that actually is on course with what they, you know, deserve for what their value is right now.
I wonder if there's some, because I'm thinking of Mookie Betts on the Red Sox, where he filed at $10.5 million and they filed at $7.5 million. So I don't know if there's like some sort of system that could be implemented where if a player kind of like reaches specific milestones in like some way, I don't know like what numbers they would use, but that player that gets like X percentage higher in arbitration as opposed to what he got paid the previous year. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I think basically arbitration is in major need of retooling, and that maybe isn't quite the question that was asked, but I do think that if that is fixed, it might, you know, also in turn fix other problems that that exist with, you know, player contract issues.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of teams try to take advantage of contract status, such as recently the two cases that I'm thinking of is how the Rays traded Evan Longoria before his 10-5 rights came in to kind of avoid having to deal with the protection that Longoria gets being a 10-5 player. And then the other thing that I'm thinking of is how Chris Bryant was, his call-up was delayed to June so that they could get an extra year out of him, you know, before arbitration and free agency and all of that. So I'm just thinking, you know, there's so many ways how teams manipulate contracts in such a way that's more beneficial to the team in itself and not the players. And I think that's one of the things that needs to change. I think that it's going to be hard to change those ones because you can't really, like, be definitive and prove that that's what they were doing. But there needs to be less of an incentive for teams to, you know, delay calling up a prospect who's more than ready or trading someone away because he's about to hit, you know, a specific time in their contract that makes them have a little bit more power and leverage over the team. I think that's some of the things that needs to change, and I don't know how it's going to change. I don't know if it's going to take a new CBA to get that done. The next time it's going to be, you know, going to be up in time for additions, but there needs to, the MLBPA certainly needs to do more when it comes to protecting the players from, you know, from, in a sense, the capitalistic ideals of a team. You know, it's not as though Chris Bryant won't be earning a lot of money, but, you know, the team wants to get the most bang for their buck and keep him on the team for longer. But, you know, why not just offer him an extension? That would be more than fair for him. But, you know, they want to try and keep him cost controlled till the last possible minute because money. So there's got to be a lot of overhaul on that, because, you know, if they were actually keeping the players' interests in mind, you know, they wouldn't be this dire, like, nothingness of no free agents being signed, or at least teams not offering, you know, players less than they're worth. I think that there's just a lot of things that need to be done.
Yeah, maybe try instituting a salary floor so that we don't have another Marlin situation anytime.
I know that the league does have some kind of salary floor, but that's for, like, guys who make their debuts or on the 40-man roster, and I believe that floor is $525,000, but there is no floor when it comes to free agency, and there needs to be a better system that creates some kind of parameters for the least amount of money you can offer a free agent on the market depending on their value.
Oh, I meant like in terms of the payroll that a team should, like, so no team, you know, can have a payroll under 100,000 or under 100 million or like something like that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
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 That's a good idea.
Just needs to be a lot of change is pretty much the gist of things.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Our perspective on baseball is, we love you, you're perfect, now change.
Yes. So our next Twitter question actually comes from our guest, Crystal, at Crush Song. Who are our favorite Negro Leagues players?
Mine is Toni Stone, who was the first woman to play in the Negro Leagues, and she kind of, you know, set the path for the other two women who followed her. And her story is just kind of remarkable. And she started to go for professional baseball when she was 19 years old, and then she had to continuously lie about her age so that teams would be able to sign her. And she just dealt with so much misogyny and sexism, you know, to try and follow her dream of playing professional baseball. And her story is just a really, really complex, interesting one.
My favorites, kind of in the same vein as Toni Stone, would probably be Mamie Johnson, also known as Peanut. She was signed by the Indianapolis Clowns in 1953 and played with the team for 2 years and had a 33-8 win-loss record and a batting average of .262. She passed away last month, but she's, you know, her and Toni Stone are probably two of my favorite Negro Leagues players. And also, my other favorite one is Minnie Mignoso, just because he had such an interesting career. It was a very long career, including, you know, coaching for the White Sox as well. And, you know, he also made three game appearances for the White Sox in September of 1978 when he was coaching. And he was scheduled to make an appearance with a minor league team, the Miami Miracle, in 1990 and become the only professional play in 6 decades. However, the MLB overruled the Miracle on the idea. So, but, you know, as a whole, he's just had a completely interesting career. He's, you know, a 9-time All-Star, 3-time Gold Glove Award winner, 3-time American League stolen base leader. His number 9 is retired with the White Sox, and, you know, he was the first Black Cuban in the major leagues and the first Black player in the White Sox history. And as a rookie in 1951, according to his bio, he was the one of the first Latin Americans to play in an MLB All-Star game. So just, you know, seeing that he had a career in the Negro Leagues and then coming up through the major leagues and leaving this long impact on the team, you know, it's always been fascinating to me.
Those are all really excellent choices. My personal favorite Negro League player is Buck O'Neill. You know, if you've watched the Ken Burns baseball documentary, you've seen him, you've heard him talk, you have probably fallen in love with him through that. But this guy was just so, so crucial to the preservation of Negro League history. He spent his life going around talking to people about Negro Leagues, telling stories about his time in the Negro Leagues and people he played with, some of the people that he, you know, didn't play with himself, but that he knew stories about. And he was just really huge in making people care about Negro League baseball who might not have otherwise. He was like the personal idol and mentor of Bob Kendrick, who is the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. There's a really great book about him called The Soul of Baseball by Joe Posnanski. It's a really fantastic read. And if you are interested at all in Buck O'Neill's life and his, you know, the kind of person that he was and his storytelling, this is definitely a book that's worth checking out. I always kind of thought, you know, if you did nothing but listen to Vin Scully broadcasts and Buck O'Neill interviews, you could learn the entire history of baseball. And that just sort of, I think, speaks to Buck O'Neill's importance. You know, he didn't have the numbers necessarily to qualify for the Hall of Fame, but nonetheless, it's a shame that he wasn't inducted, neither while he was alive or after the fact, because he deserves to be in there because his role in preserving Negro League history was just so, so huge. And it's kind of heartbreaking and infuriating that that never happens.
Strongly agreed about Buck O'Neill and everything you said about him. He is an incredible, incredible human being, especially just to, you know, preserve the history of the Negro Leagues, which, you know, a lot of it has already been lost to time. So whatever has been, you know, recollected and able for so many people to see is crucial to baseball as a whole.
Yeah, good choices, everyone. Good job.
Our next question is from Cam Goldner. What is our favorite Negro Leagues team, and why is it the Cleveland Spiders? Okay. One, Cam, Cleveland Spiders is not the Negro Leagues, and two, I would say it's the Kansas City Monarchs.
My answer has to be the Atlanta Black Crackers, because that is a name. Like, oh my God. Like, first of all, it's unbelievable that there was a team called the Atlanta Crackers. But to sort of take that and flip it on its head and call a Negro League team the Atlanta Black Crackers, it's just, it's amazing that that's a thing that happened.
That is a really fantastic name. I'm going to go with the San Francisco Sea Lions because they only lasted a little over a season, but were kind of integral in creating the first Western Negro League, even though it disbanded after a season as well. But they just kind of made black baseball possible on the West Coast, where before it was no longer possible. They're the first professional team really to give Toni Stone a fair shot, and they were integral in getting her into the Negro Leagues.
All very good choices. Yeah, I'm just kind of looking through, you know, the different Negro Leagues teams. You know, there's so many of them. So many of them were extremely interesting, and, you know, just the history of the Negro Leagues is so fascinating. I know I've never gotten a chance to go, but if you're ever in Kansas City, please do go visit the Negro Leagues Museum. Our next question comes from AJ at AJ on the Guitar. Any phrases from announcers that have burned into your brain? Despite my Dodger fandom, I often find myself saying from one of the old A's commentators, tell it goodbye.
Go ahead. Well, perhaps because of my Dodger fandom, I'm going to have to go for Vin Scully naturally. And there's a couple. Well, there's more than just a couple, but I'm going to keep it brief. The big one is, hi, and a very pleasant good evening to you wherever you may be, as well as it's time for Dodger baseball. You know, those two things that you heard before every game, just forever burned in my brain. And also, one of my favorite Vinisms is sometimes, you know, he was really good at describing weather conditions, which, you know, it seems like a weird thing to praise someone for, but it's important for a baseball game, you know, to be able to talk about the conditions that players are playing under. And whenever there was just a light breeze blowing out, he would talk about how there was barely a zephyr to stir the flags. And I always thought that was just really beautifully said.
So I think for me, the first one that instantly comes to mind is Berman's back during the home run derby. Just because we had to listen to so many home runs over so many years and never going to leave my head. And then another kind of like more team-oriented personal one has to be the pizza incident where Jerry Remy and Don Arcillo are commentating it on replay, and Remy says, here comes the pizza, as this fan throws a piece of pizza at another fan in Fenway, and it glances off of the second person's shoulder. If you haven't seen the video, it is hilarious, so I encourage everybody to go watch it. And that's just what I think about whenever I am at a ballpark and see a slice of pizza.
For me, it would probably be, being a Giants fan, two things from John Miller. The first one is his home run call, which is adios pelota. Every time, you know, I see someone kicking a ball to the middle of nowhere, or just, you know, a ball being thrown anywhere, I just yell, adios pelota. The other thing is, so this was from Giants Fan Fest in 2011, I believe, 2011, 2012, one of those years. they have a Q&A panel with, you know, players and broadcasters, and I just happened to pass by when John Miller was on the stage, and he started telling Vin Scully stories. And one of the things that John Miller is known for is his Vin Scully impression. So I remember I had my tape recorder out, so I listened to this quite a bit, and then it's John Miller imitating Vin Scully calling not a game, but the goings-on of a morning and breakfast being made. So I just get it stuck in my head sometimes where John Miller, as Vin Scully, says, "Good morning, darling, pull up a chair. There's Farmer John on the stove and, you know, sausage being made." And he just keeps going on for like a minute or two, just kind of like describing the kitchen. So that's been stuck in my head for the past 6 or 7 years.
That's awesome.
Moving on to the article summaries of the past week. Sarah?
Thank you, Jen. On Monday, we have "Tommy John Should Be in the Hall of Fame" by Bradley Woodrum. As the title suggests, Bradley believes that Tommy John, recipient of the pioneering surgery named for him, deserves to be inducted into Cooperstown. For many, John's role in changing the sport forever is not enough alone. They'd argue that his career numbers, while good, don't reach the level of greatness required of a Hall of Famer. However, Bradley argues that there's some different ways of looking at John's numbers that the modern era committee voters ought to consider, including John's unmatched success following his surgery. You should check this out if for no reason other than that Bradley just got hired to work in the Marlins analytics department, and this is your last chance to read his work. It's kind of crazy that two Fangraphs people just left to go work for major league teams in the same week. That's a little bit of a sidebar, but pretty cool. Then on Tuesday, we have "Spinning Wheel, Got to Go Round" by Dave Vocale. I hope I said that right. Dave writes about an eventful doubleheader at Comiskey Park in 1977 in which three players, Dick Allen, Wilbur Wood, and Lamar Johnson, experience what the author describes as a synchronous career moment. Allen, playing for the Oakland A's, would make his last ever appearance in a major league game. Wood, starting for the White Sox, would pick up his first win in more than a year. And Johnson, in addition to singing the national anthem, would hit two home runs. This article also drops the fun fact that MC Hammer was an A's bat boy in the 70s, which is something I did not know. Then on Wednesday, we have "If I'm the Pope" by Joe Distelheim. And this kind of ties into the Twitter question that we got from AJ, so this is kind of fun. In his piece, Joe bemoans a sports casting cliche that he finds particularly irritating. "If I'm so-and-so, I do such-and-such." Joe channels his frustration with this phrase into a sort of manifesto, detailing the decisions and changes he'd make to the game of baseball if it was him in various positions of authority. Joe also invites readers to share their own "if I'm" examples in the comments, so check out his piece and respond if you feel so inclined. Mary?
And on Thursday, we have "The DraftKings" by Dave Jordan. This piece analyzes MLB teams according to how good they are at drafting talent, first using Detroit's 1976 draft of Steve Kemp, Dan Petrie, and Ozzie Smith, and Anaheim's 1968 draft of Bill Buckner and Steve Garvey as examples. But each of these picks occurred fairly early in the draft, in contrast to teams that amassed talent from much later picks. So, which team has amassed the most future WAR, as Dave titles it? You'll have to read the piece to find out. And closing out the week, we have "Card Corner Plus: The Beauty of 83 Tops and the Mystery of Lee Mazzilli" by Bruce Markison. Though many of us fondly remember opening packs of Tops cards as youth, the reality is that by the mid-70s, the company, thanks to a baseball card monopoly, had become lazy, creating cheap, boring, and ugly cards that offered little to no visual appeal. However, a 1980 court ruling dissolved the monopoly, allowing both Donruss and Fleer to enter the market, forcing Tops to create more high-quality and interesting cards. Bruce takes us through the early years of the decade, focusing on a peculiar 1983 Lee Mazzilli card.
And for next week, we'll be off on Monday in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Later in the week, we have Stacey Gatsoulias returning with another random box score. Alfonso Tusa tells a story of a favorite pitcher who threw a one-hitter in the Venezuelan Winter League. Brian Reinhart fills us in on Prince Fielder's cooking and travel show. And then Steve Goldman digs in on a Tigers outfielder with a wonderful name of Pernell Goldie. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen McRamos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. And you can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. You can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THC and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. And check back next week for another episode.